coffee lovers know that the secret to a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But how do you know when the coffee you buy was roasted? Most brands are just offering you a crapshoot. But now there's Sparkplug Coffee! Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's guaranteed to be fresh and at its peak flavor, whether you're drinking it here in Canada or if you've been dragged against your will to Des Moines. You will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Give my daughter the coffee!
And action!
Welcome to the next 100 Project, movie lovers, and thank you much for earing us up. Since our 123 weeks of reviewing AFI movies is long done, now we watch movies that intrigue us. If you think spoilers are offensive, go somewhere else and don't be offended anymore. Wait, don't go anywhere. Well, we're going to spoil. I am your host of The Male Persuasion, Ryan Ellis, and here to my right is my ladylike co-host, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, well, the 2016 Oscars were last night. We recorded this podcast before the show, so we'll just have to assume that it was a speedy broadcast with no filler. Everyone who won should have won, and there is currently no criticism of it on Twitter or Facebook.
Seems pretty likely.
And I guess we'll comment on the show as the next few months play out. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Terms of Endearment, our final Oscar movie in Oscar month. Larry McMurtry wrote the book Terms of Endearment, and James L. Brooks directed the movie. In Brooks's 6 movies as a director and McMurtry's 8 books that have been adapted for the big screen, which of them has had more Oscar acting nominations in the 6 and in the 8?
I can only find 7 McMurtry books that have been adapted to movies. But he still wins. He still had more nominations and more wins than Brooks. Brooks had nominations for Terms of Endearment, Broadcast News, and As Good As It Gets.
4, 3, and 3.
Mm-hmm. And McMurtry had 11 nominations between HUD, The Last Picture Show, and Terms of Endearment.
You're missing a big one. He had 14.
What am I missing?
Brokeback Mountain.
You mean the novella by Annie E. Proulx?
Oh.
That he wrote for the screen?
That's right. Oh, fuck.
Ryan's never wrong, but he was wrong about something! And I knew it! This never happens again.
He was a writer. It wasn't like he was the art director or a.
You said, just listen, a guy the on question the specifically was his book adapted, and that was not his book.
Oh, I didn't look as carefully as I should have on the IMDb. Well, he still did win, you're right. It was 11 to 10 then, wasn't it? Oh, well, the next 100 Project's 52nd motion picture, Terms of Endearment, was nominated for, but failed to make, both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. After a November premiere in 1983, Paramount Pictures threw it out wide on December 9th. The movie didn't even cost 8 million smackers, but it made over 100 million. Bad, remind people about this ancient movie, kind of ancient, a little old, with the skinny.
I decline to call any movie ancient that was made in our lifetime.
Well, we're old. We're ancient.
No.
I'm 43 now.
Oh, so old.
I'm going to walk up the stairs.
All right, anyway, that's skinny. Shirley MacLaine is Aurora, a fussy Texas widow, and Deborah Winger is her goofy, irreverent daughter, Emma. We follow their difficult yet affectionate relationship over the course of 3 decades, joined by Jeff Daniels as Emma's husband, Flap, John Lithgow as her lover, and, of course, Jack Nicholson as Aurora's rowdy, retired astronaut neighbor, Garrett.
Jack. Haven't seen that guy in a while, have we? Not since Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh my gosh,
last
really?
Last movie reviewed with Jack in it, yeah. Or, in a nutshell, if you sneeze in the first act, you have to die in the third act. And she does. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 88% of critics like this movie, 37% fresh, 5% rotten, and 84% of audiences. Not bad, not awesome, not terrible, though, pretty solid scores. And it was number 2 at the 1983 U.S. box office. Not surprisingly, Return of the Jedi was numero uno. I think every year the Star Wars movies, no, not true. Attack of the Clones was not number 1 in 2002. But I think every other year Star Wars movies come out, it's been number 1, including Rogue One from last year, has taken over the top spot.
What beat Attack of the Clones? Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, Beb, a love story between a mother and a daughter. The men matter, but they're mostly incidental. And what did you think of Terms of Endearment?
I think terms of endearment accomplishes the remarkable achievement of being a guilty pleasure that you really don't feel that guilty about. It hits all those great soapy notes of drama without making you think too hard or question your view of the world. But it's also smart and authentic. It steers clear of cliches and gives you like a really unique, delightful experience. I take issue with a couple of aspects of the film, but not so much that I can't thoroughly enjoy it.
Yeah, it's still pretty enjoyable. There's a lot of great touches too. Things like Flap burning rubber after Emma says, "Drive away slow." Or the kid. This is the one I'd like the most, I think. It's actually, of all the nice touches in the movie, when, is it Tommy or Teddy? I think it's Tommy, right? Because he's the older one. The parents are going upstairs to have sex. Puts on his coat. He goes outside. It's the winter. He sits on the porch. Obviously, he's done this many times before because they're a very sexual couple. But the little tap of his foot, I think it's the most of all. It's almost like this impatient little thing, but maybe not so impatient because he's been down this road before with these two, obviously. Other great touches like Teddy, the middle child, giving up the candy bar at the grocery store. I don't need it.
Oh.
And this is such a nice touch, but it is proof of Flap's affair when he's flirting while a baby is strapped to his chest. But we don't see that. And a really nice reveal, actually. Nicely set up. Nicely directed by a rookie director, James L. Brooks.
I do love that you mentioned the scene where the kid puts his coat on and just goes outside and sits. One of the many examples of parenting style that would never fly with today's parents, the way that they raise their kids. Things that would just be considered neglect, where they let them take off by themselves. That kid sitting on the front porch by himself, at his age, no parent would even let him put his shoes on by himself and put his coat on. They wouldn't trust him to do that.
Now.
He's like under 4 years old. Yeah, now.
Then, of course, sure.
But it's amazing to watch this movie and think, oh my gosh, how much has changed in parenting in the last 35 years.
And then the two kids, Tommy and Teddy, walk off when there's a big fight. Emma does come to find them later on. That's not so unusual even now for the two boys to go together at least. But again, something you'd maybe be a little bit more reserved about. Oh no, you're never leaving this property without us saying so. Or yeah, taking you to the park or the kid's house or wherever you're going. I mean, they're just getting the hell off of the property is all it comes down to.
And I think you see her slap him pretty hard on the face. And
well, especially Aurora does it to Tommy at the very end. Mom is too lazy to get us into Boy Scouts or something.
Oh, she slaps him so hard, she knocks him down. Yeah.
Good sell job by that kid.
Yes.
These two kids who play Tommy and Teddy are very believable and very good. Huckleberry Fox and Troy Bishop. So Huckleberry Fox plays Teddy and Troy Bishop plays Tommy, the older kid. Tommy is perpetually disappointed in his dad, even when he's a little kid. He seems to see through his father's crap, even when he's a young boy.
Yeah, he seems to be a little wise beyond his years.
And even maybe his mother, because the scene where Emma first meets Sam, he has a good laugh in that scene where the clerk says something rude to him and he says, "You must be from New York." And I'm sure everybody that wasn't from New York and middle America that probably liked this movie too to make it such a big hit probably got a huge kick out of that. But then when they go into the parking lot and Sam wants to still talk to her, now, honey, go over the car, honey. She's screaming at him. She doesn't hit him there, but she's screaming in his face to leave her alone, which is also funny.
You mentioned the dig on the cashier. It's not the only dig New York takes in this movie either, because when she goes to New York to visit her friend Patsy, those New York women and their
awful,
judgy ways. I don't know why Hollywood loves to believe that women, when they're left to their own devices, are so mean and catty and tactless. It's not even funny. It doesn't even make a point to me. It just makes me roll my eyes and be embarrassed for the filmmakers.
It's more behind their back that it would happen rather than to their face, right?
A little bit, but even that being said, in the early 80s, there's no way a group of women would have been outraged and shocked that a woman, a mother, would have made the choice to raise her kids instead of having a job. People don't even get judgy about that now.
Well, they can, but yeah, I think you're right. That's
not the way, not nearly to the extreme level that they do in that scene where they literally like stop talking, drop their forks and stare at her like an alien just climbed out of her head. They're so shocked and offended that she might have chose to be a mom, a full-time mom.
That must be from McMurtry's source material, because I can't see Jim Brooks being that way. I don't know if he's from New York, but he is an L.A., New York kind of guy. He'd been in the business a long time as a TV producer already, so it seems like it's a bit of a cheap shot if he was the one originating that. It probably came from the novel. Well, speaking of locations, this movie is unusual in that it starts in Houston, which is, of course, a huge city, especially now, but then it goes to Des Moines and then Nebraska, and they actually shot a lot of the movie in Nebraska, setting scenes that were supposed to be in Des Moines, or probably in Houston, too. So Jim Brooks was Alexander Payne before Alexander Payne came along, because, of course, Payne's the one who shoots, or at least sets, so many movies in Nebraska. And the production was chaotic. Some blamed Brooks for that. I think even Shirley MacLaine did. But he was a rookie director. He'd been producing for a while and writing in television. Mary Tyler Moore, Taxi, I think Rhoda, he also worked on that one. But as a director of a feature film, it's a whole different job. And he was the writer, director, and producer. He got right into all three jobs in his first time out.
The movie lends itself well to a TV sensibility because it's episodic by nature. It takes place over decades. You have these back and forth scenes with Aurora's life and Emma's life. They undergo all these life events, but it's incredibly consistent in tone and their character, the way a TV show should be. And maybe that's a weakness too, because it seems like the characters don't undergo a great deal of change over the course of the film. And one of my favorite complaints, the score is, in my opinion, terrible, overused, so TV sounding. Like, as soon as there's a moment where there's an emotional note at all, that music comes in loud and it's not remotely subtle or appropriate, and it seems corny.
Michael Gore was the composer. He's guilty of that, I guess. He was nominated for an Oscar. I thought the music was fine, but you, of course, don't like music generally, certainly this kind of music.
I like a lot of music, but I...
But this kind. You've made it very clear in many of our podcasts. But getting back to the whole thing about it being a small movie, not really stage-bound. It was never a stage play at all, but it's more of a TV movie that was made for the big screen. It deserves to be on the big screen. You got all these big actors. Nicholson doesn't do TV. You just don't see him do TV shows the way a lot of people do, whether it be appearing on The Tonight Show to promote something. McClane doesn't do a lot of TV, and Deborah Winger is really off the scene altogether. So that's the thing. You've got all these big stars that are in the movie, so that makes it a movie rather than a TV show. But it was a personal film that won 5 Oscars, and then Epics won Best Picture for years afterwards, maybe discounting Platoon, but that's also set in a foreign country. But the year after this, you got Amadeus. Not really maybe an epic, but a bigger movie, also overseas, about Mozart.
A period film.
Out of Africa, set in Africa. Definitely an epic, huge, grand scope. Then you got Platoon. Then you got The Last Emperor, another foreign set film. Rain Man, you're getting back now to more personal stuff, although it's a road movie. So I wonder if maybe that was a reaction in all the voting and all those years against the TV producer who dared to succeed at movies, too.
Do they have a problem with that?
I don't know. But this guy winning the Best Picture, Best Director, and the screenplay, he won the 3 that night. That had rarely been done before. It's rarely been done since. I don't know if it was a reaction against him, but then also Ordinary People, only a few years before that, was also a small movie in that sense. It's a people leading humdrum lives kind of film that won the major Oscars. Not as many as this one, but it did win Best Picture and Best Director for Redford. And Hollywood reacts against that kind of stuff sometimes. I mean, look at this year's Oscars, where so many people who aren't white, we say that because Dev Patel's not black. So 6 black people, as I recall, and then the Indian guy, are in the 20 acting categories after 2 straight years of nobody. None of the 7 are really unworthy, except maybe Dev Patel. His co-star, Sunny Pawar, was more worthy than he was.
Definitely.
So they're all pretty good choices to at least be in that category. Again, we don't know who won. But that seems to be at least some reaction against what happened for 2 straight years of nobody of color being nominated.
But you really have to take into consideration what was in theaters in any given year. And like I said in our Oscar podcast, I think part of the reason the Oscars are finally diverse this year is because there was great diversity in films in the theater this year.
Yeah.
And great films, too. So I wonder if it was a reaction of Hollywood years ago from criticism it received just over the years of Oscars being too white. And because the public keeps going to see these diverse films. And while there were certainly plenty of movies that follow in the footsteps of Terms of Endearment and Ordinary People, how often is a movie like that this good?
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'm just saying that Hollywood can do that sometimes, and I think even more so in the early 80s. The TV guy made a movie that maybe belonged on TV, so let's go bigger and grander, especially in Out of Africa and The Last Emperor.
I think it probably counts for the appetite of the public, too, where we tend to get really into one thing and then get bored of it and move on to its total opposite.
Well, as I say that, though, too, I think about Rain Man, which is basically a 2-man show and 1 woman, Valeria Galino. Otherwise, it's pretty much just Cruise and Hoffman in the whole movie. But it is, as I said, a road movie. And then Driving Miss Daisy the year after that, though, a 2-person movie with, you know, Dan Aykroyd's in it, too. So they really did diversify in that decade, didn't they? But there was that stretch where they had the big epics that mostly won. And I just wonder, it was a speculation. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. So, back to Terms of Endearment. The other thing about this film that's certainly well-known is that Deborah Winger and Shirley MacLaine fought hard during production. And it's been said that Winger was on coke, and maybe that's part of the problem. Not to just blame her, because it takes 2 to fight, but this was not a very easy-to-do shoot. And again, Brooks was probably not helping that by things being chaotic. And as for the characters, when Emma's happy, Aurora is lonely. And then the reverse is true. When Aurora finally gets happy with Garrett, when they start settling down a little bit, or at least having some fun together, that's when Emma is reaching out for Sam and doesn't get to keep Sam because she gets moved. It almost seems like they can't be happy at the same time.
I mean, the movie does a great job of showing the rhythm of life. without over-dramatizing events that really aren't that dramatic. It makes some really bold choices by having both Emma and Flap have affairs that are practically non-issues. I mean, Flap's affair is kind of an issue, although she seems pretty ready to forgive him and carry on with their life. She cheated too, he never finds out about it, and therefore it's like not an issue at all. I don't condone infidelity, but I found it really refreshing to see a movie character, especially a female movie character, have an affair and suffer no real ill consequences of it. As a matter of fact, in the language of this film, that affair was the right thing for her to do. It was what she needed at the time. It's what Sam, John Lithgow's character, needed at the time. They made each other happy. They kind of got through tough times of their own, and then they got back to their regular lives. It was just like an episode in their lives. That's what the movie does, is it doesn't turn the whole plot on one dramatic thing or another. It just does this really great job of illustrating how the rhythm of life actually works.
It's not Fatal Attraction, where that one affair ruins people's lives and it's the whole plot line. And that movie's fun, but it's unrealistic.
And it's not the Hollywood tendency that they have to punish their characters for doing something immoral.
Because back 40 years before this movie was made, or even 30, or maybe even less than that, they would have been punished. Not maybe, definitely. And we have evidence that she cheats on Flap before Flap cheats on her. Flap was cheating first, the night when he comes home from supposedly sleeping on the couch all night long. He was obviously cheating, but in film language, we don't see that happening. We never see either of them actually with their lover. We see him with the baby on his chest, flirting with the girl, and we know, okay, he's been cheating obviously all this time.
And then, of course, the girl follows him to Nebraska.
Oh, yeah.
So we know it wasn't just him sleeping with co-eds, it was having a proper affair with this woman, so much so that she moved states to follow him.
And nicely done early on that these two are so passionate, including the scene where Tommy has to go outside because the parents are boning yet again. They're very passionate in the early days of the movie, and it seems like for many years.
That's another refreshing thing about the film, is to see a married couple that's still having sex after all these years, and to see a woman, Deborah Winger, who's totally into it.
Mm-hmm.
She's just as lusty as he is.
I love that you came back.
Oh, that's such a cute line. Can we talk about Deborah Winger as Emma?
No, we can't talk about Emma. No.
Her performance to me is what makes the film great. You know, it's a good film, but she is just so natural and real. She's this woman who's a totally believable person, but her charm is infectious. It's hard to believe there's a co-ed in the world who could make her husband's attention stray. She's just so dynamic and fun.
And looking pretty good. Deborah Winger is not the greatest beauty in the history of Hollywood, but she's a nice looking lady. And they never make her look all that bad, even when she's got cancer, because this is a Hollywood movie and she's got cancer. I think it was Anne Jackson says, "You're always dying in a key light." She still looks okay. And actually, by movie standards of 30 or 40 years before, she looks worse than they do. Greta Garbo won those movies. They might have been Camille. She died looking Greta Garbo-esque rather than sick at all. But as for the character in general, Emma is drawn to self-centered husbands and mothers. She can't help being drawn to her mother because it's her mother. But she's drawn to this guy, Flap, who isn't a bad guy, though. He's actually very well drawn. And even though I love Jack and he won the Oscar for supporting actor, Jeff Daniels didn't get a nomination. John Lithgow is barely in the movie. He's very good. And by the way, if you ever listen to this podcast, hey, John, it's Lithgow, not Lithgow.
My apologies.
One of the many names gets mispronounced. But anyway, Jeff Daniels, the unsung hero of Hollywood for a long time, along with Kurt Russell, and there's other actors you can put in this camp too, but that guy's been good for a very long time, and he's great in this film. This is a woman's film. The guys are more incidental. But of those three male co-stars, the other two were nominated for Oscars and he wasn't, he's easily the most important one.
And it's refreshing that Emma's affair is treated with more honesty. His philandering is also treated with authenticity. He's kind of a jerk, but he's lots of things. He can be a jerk, he can be selfish in the way that he carries on affairs with these other women, but he can also love his wife and he can love his kids and he can be a sweet guy. And he plays those contradictions in a really believable way.
Except that his kids, or at least his oldest kid, don't seem to respect him, even when they're young kids.
And speaking of his kids and of movies that were made in the 80s, the ending where he gives up his children without remotely a fight, and his wife and his mother-in-law are like, "Please, Flap, as if you're going to parent your children." And it was just 4 years before that Kramer versus Kramer was made. We need a whole movie just to make the argument that a man can be a parent. So I guess that was the 80s, but it is hard to wrap my 2017 brain around the idea that a father just wouldn't automatically take his children and never another word be said about it.
Well, that's what Emma wants, and that's the only reason I can understand why he would just let it happen, because he doesn't like Aurora. They come to somewhat of an understanding, maybe by the end of the film, but they still don't like each other very much. She's never been good to him, and he hasn't been very good in return, and after a while, she kind of deserves to not get good in return from him. But unless he never missed his kids and loved his freedom just that much, that at some point, after a few years, he'd forget what Emma said about, you shouldn't raise them, it should be my mother raising them. And maybe come back and say, I'm back in the picture. I don't think Jeff Daniels was in the sequel, The Evening Star. I haven't seen it in a long time. I don't recall. The kids are messed up. I know that's part of the whole plot line because they weren't raised by their parents. One's dead and one's out of the picture. But I agree with you that I don't really buy that. And you know what? I mentioned Ordinary People and there's other movies in the 80s that won Oscars. And even though it was the 70s, I forgot. Kramer versus Kramer is the cousin of this movie. Not Ordinary People, not Driving Miss Daisy, and not any of those other ones I mentioned.
But both Kramer vs. Kramer and Ordinary People are movies where you have incredibly affectionate and competent fathers. Maybe they don't start out that way in either movie, but they get there because they're forced to by the failure of a mother.
You're giving Flap way too much credit.
No. I'm not saying him. I'm saying Ordinary People and Kramer vs. Kramer are movies like that.
Oh, man.
So in the 80s, my suggestion is people are coming around to the idea that men are perfectly capable of raising their children. Maybe it's less shocking that he would abandon his children to his mother-in-law that he doesn't even like in the first place. But what's harder to swallow in the movie is that it's treated really casually. Yeah. Very matter of fact. Oh, come on, Flap. It's cute that you want to pretend to want your children, but I think we all know a woman has to care for them.
And since we're talking about Ordinary People so much, for whatever it's worth with Oscar nominations, Donald Sutherland was the one of that cast of the major players that didn't get nominated, just like Jeff Daniels in this film. And in both cases, they're not the best thing in the movie, but they're up there. Sutherland is terrific in Ordinary People, but it wasn't him. Mary Tyler Moore was nominated, and Tim Hutton, and Judd Hirsch, but not Sutherland. But in both cases, Sutherland and Daniels never nominated once in all their really great careers.
So what do you think of the award-winning performance of Jack Nicholson?
I'm a Jack fan. I think anyone who knows me knows he's my favorite actor of all time. That doesn't mean I excuse the fact that he has phoned it in. Actually, that's not fair. He doesn't phone it in. De Niro, as great as he's been, phones it in. Nicholson overdoes it so often. And for the most part, this movie's not overdoing it. He's probably playing about where they wanted him to be. Presumably, Brooks maybe leveled him out a little bit so he wouldn't go so far over the top because, as I've said many times, as much as I love Cuckoo's Nest, that's where Jack first went over the top and never really seemed to come back except here and there. He did some movies in the late 70s, early 80s. The Border is a movie he did where he was very contained, not being Jack. But then the year after, Terms of Endearment, Border was 82, this is 83, he's back to being Jack-esque. So is it a good performance? I don't know. The three times he's won Oscars, as much as I love Cuckoo's Nest, again, I liked As Good As It Gets, he was over the top by normal acting standards, and even by his own standards. Cuckoo's Nest, he was overdue. He should have won at least by that point. This one he won for supporting actor and then back to being a best actor for As Good As It Gets. But in none of those performances is he as good as he was in Chinatown or Five Easy Pieces or probably even About Schmidt in the sense of being a real actor, but being Jack, and we all love Jack, and I guess that's why he won all those times, because it's like he was due the first time, and then, oh, he's fun in this movie, and he is really great in that way. This would have been Burt Reynolds, but Burt turned it down, and I would have liked to have actually seen Burt Reynolds take a shot at this, because Jack is cool, and Jack is good-looking to a lot of women, but Burt Reynolds, especially in the early 80s, was still a fox, a superstar-looking guy, and maybe in a strange way that would have been cooler to have him be the love interest for Shirley MacLaine, rather than Jack Nicholson, because Nicholson and McClane are actually really well matched, and maybe Reynolds would have been a better choice because he's not well matched for her physically.
I totally agree. I like Jack Nicholson's performance in this movie, and I like Jack Nicholson in general.
Yeah.
But one of my biggest problems with the film is I just don't buy that Aurora would give him the time of day. She has suitors for days, and he treats her with nothing but contempt. Now, if it was Burt Reynolds, sex appeal oozes out of that man's pores.
And charm. They both have the charm. Yeah. Reynolds had as much or more than Jack did at this point in his career.
Jack Nicholson is charming, but he's not sexy.
Some would say he is, but I'm with you on that.
Okay, but not like Burt Reynolds is sexy. Burt Reynolds, it just comes easily to him. And Burt Reynolds in the early 80s, I totally buy it. But I just didn't buy this dirtbag with a heart of gold act. I find his character and Aurora's attraction to him completely confounding. You know, in most cases, the dude acts nice until he gets laid, and then he turns into an asshole. Yet here, he's a gross lech until she sleeps with him, and then he turns into a softie. It doesn't make sense. And their lunch date, how am I supposed to make sense of that entire sequence? Her acceptance of his behavior implies that she has no dignity or self-respect, which is not true of her character in the rest of the films. Totally inconsistent. And it would be one thing if she enjoyed letting loose, getting drunk, getting soaked in the ocean, but she hates it. Why is she seeing this guy?
I like the touch where he straightens his hair after the convertible ride and she's a complete mess, but he's ready to go. It's a little patted down at the hair and he's all set to go.
Listen, it's a funny scene, but it should have ended with them hating each other. For it to end with him always being on her mind and her never forgetting the presumed affections of this man or his standing offer for cheap sex, his gross construction worker come-ons to her.
Okay, when you put it that way, I guess it defeats what I'm about to say, but she seems to want something different. We don't see her husband. We hear him, and that's Albert Brooks. Oh, even when I know it's him, I don't recognize the voice, as he's a good actor, I guess he's putting on a voice. He'd worked with Jim Brooks before, and he would work with him in Broadcast News a few years later and be great in it. And also in I'll Do Anything in 1994, the failure in between this and Broadcast News and As Good As It Gets. But you get the feeling that wasn't exactly a fun marriage or a sexual marriage. Danny DeVito as Vernon, one of her suitors, who was in Taxi, so that's one reason why he got cast, because Brooks was a producer on Taxi. Clearly not a sexual suitor. And the other guys you see, not sexual suitors. So maybe the idea is, with Jack, it's so fan-bleepin-tastic.
Okay, so I will concede that there are women in the world who would happily sleep with a dirtbag like Garrett. What's Breedlove?
Breedlove.
Come on with the on-the-nose name, Breedlove. Anyways, I will concede that there are women who would totally dig a guy like that. But those are not the same women who spend decades in celibacy waiting for the right washed-up wino scrub to sweep them off their feet. The world is filled to the brim with men who treat women like shit. If that's Aurora's type, Emma would have had a revolving door of mean, drunk stepdads.
Yeah, and years go by between Garrett asking Aurora out the first time and her saying yes, which is a strange deal because if she wanted to go out with him, why did she wait so long? Weeks, okay, but years?
That's my one complaint for the film. But to come back to something I really liked about it, you mentioned the scene with Albert Brooks as the dad. I think the funniest scene in the movie, in my opinion, and it sets the tone. There's good writing right there, and I think this came from the book, as a matter of fact, but she comes in, she's convinced that her new baby is dead of crib death, she's panicking unnecessarily. She's also wearing this ridiculous outfit with heels while she's checking on the baby, and she pinches the baby until she wakes up, and as soon as she starts crying, she's satisfied.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect summation of their relationship, their whole life, that she is selfish, but she's selfish in an affectionate way. She's selfish about the way she wants to love her daughter, even though she very, very much loves her daughter. It's such a well-written scene, and it's also hysterical. It sets the tone so
perfectly. Tiny capsule. It's almost like a parody of a commercial rather than the beginning of a film. Well, all the phone calls they exchange, and Aurora even says, can you imagine the phone bill? Would Aurora be a texter if she lived now? Wouldn't be so expensive, at least.
She would be a Skyper. It's hard to wrap my head around, even though we lived through it, that there was a time when moving to a different state actually meant that you would lose touch with just about everybody you left behind because long-distance phone calls were prohibitively expensive. Maybe not for someone who has a Renoir, but for most of us regular normies, those bills would actually stop you from calling your mother.
But then she's got so much money that they're going to her for money more than once in this film. I talked about nice touches, a few other ones I really like. Garrett says to Aurora at one point, you bring out the devil in me. And that's followed by a scene where Sam is talking about God and the devil. And one of Jack Nicholson's sweetest moments in the history of his career is definitely one line, Aurora, right towards the end. It's in Nebraska and Emma's dying. Aurora's there, of course. And then Garrett shows up to be there for what seems to be only a few days. But at least he does show that he cares enough to bother going there. And then that little bit at the end with the kid, too, where he takes him to go swimming, get his mind off of the funeral, and it looks like he's going to be a family man.
One of my favorite Shirley MacLaine moments of all time, when she says she loves him at the airport, he walks away, and she's, Garrett! He's like, I got away.
All I can do is give you my stock answer, which is, I love you too, kid.
It's such a great scene.
Probably like, something Jack's really said to women, too, in reality.
Oh, probably. And as much as I have problems with their relationship and everything in the movie, that scene's just so satisfying and fun to watch.
Well, we're in the cancer sequence at this point in the podcast, so it's the end of the movie. Emma has got cancer, and apparently Flap has a tapeworm. The hospital cafeteria scene, when he meets up with Aurora, he's got lunch for three people.
He's eating like a hobbit in a hurry.
And then, of course, everyone probably feels this way if they like this movie. The two kids with their mother at the end. You were grabbing the tissues. I wasn't crying, but I'm not going to deny that it's a very tear-jerking kind of scene.
I don't know how you're not crying.
And the two little boys were great in it, too. Deborah Winger's paid to be good at that kind of stuff, and she's very good in this scene. But the kids are great, too, especially Teddy. I don't know what they did to make him cry, but that poor little boy really sold it.
Oh, my God. That scene kills me. Like, when I knew it was coming, I was mentally trying to shore up The defenses.
You cry.
Well, then I cried. There were no defenses. There's nothing I could do in the face of that. And also, for all of their fighting throughout the entire movie, Flap and Aurora have to turn to each other when they're the only ones in that hospital bed when she finally goes. And I love her line. I think anyone who's experienced a death close to them can understand this. I thought it would be a relief once it's over, but it's worse. And it is, you know, you think once all of the agonizing and waiting, you just want it to come to an end. But then when it's over and they're gone, there's no getting them back.
No more lines to say, no more little arguments or laughs to have with them. It's fitting that Flap is asleep when Emma dies, but Aurora sees it happen.
Because they're the principal relationship. Mm-hmm. I wonder if part of the reason her and Flap aren't as close as they could be as husband and wife is because she's always had her mother. Like, she never has needed Flap the way most spouses need their husband or their wife, because she has such an almost unnatural closeness with her mother that she doesn't have to lean on him.
And as for the very last scene, the funeral reception, did you notice the very last shot of the whole film is Aurora with her granddaughter? And I guess that's the new Emma. Juliette Lewis plays her in The Evening Star, and the primary battle in that film, as I recall, is Shirley MacLaine and Juliette Lewis. So nice lead into a movie they didn't even know they'd make, necessarily.
And The Evening Star was not all that well reviewed.
No,
I mean, you've seen it.
Or successful.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson must really like Shirley MacLaine. Of course, she is the sister of his old friend Warren Beatty. But to have been in The Evening Star, he's only ever been in two sequels. Do you know what the other sequel is?
The Two Jakes?
That's right. Nicely done. Which he directed.
Pat me on the head.
Well, I had to look it up. I thought he must have been in more than two.
Well, he directed it, so I always remember that.
Okay, right. And speaking of Jack, we thought his career was over. We thought it was going to end with a Jim Brooks movie, How Do You Know?, which was pretty bad, despite the good cast. But now we just learned a few weeks ago he's going to be in a remake of one of the foreign language Oscar nominees, maybe it won, who knows, Tony Erdmann. And when I read about what that character is that he'll play, I think he's going to jack it up a little bit. I got to wonder, though, is there a cure for Alzheimer's? Because it sounded like Jack maybe had Alzheimer's.
Well, he said he was having trouble remembering lines.
Years ago, too.
He was sick.
Yeah, but years and years ago.
Okay, but if he had Alzheimer's years ago, there's no chance that he would be well enough to do
film
now.
I guess that's true. Hey,
so it must just be like old age. He just couldn't do it anymore, and maybe he misses it. And you say he's going to jack it up. Why would he come out of retirement to make a movie if he couldn't jack it up? Oh, and I'm dying to see Tony Erdmann. Heard so many amazing things about it. So I'll definitely watch the German thing before I see the Hollywood version of it.
With Kristen Wiig. Well, we covered him on Easy Rider, Chinatown, Cuckoo's Nest. In this movie, he's got no vanity. You see his gut. There's another thing about it that's fine. And he's a middle-aged guy. And he has to, at the end of the movie, accept that he's a middle-aged loser astronaut who finally accepts that he isn't the dashing young playboy. I like another scene he has, actually, that no one really ever talks about in this film, where he says, the guys and I never got together. That's why I said loser astronaut. He must have been either the outcast, or maybe none of them really got together. And that seems to be his whole big thing. Maybe he's overcompensating for the fact he's lonely, not having his old male friends, by sleeping with anything he possibly can.
Well, he's certainly compensating for the fact that his glory days are far behind him. And they have a great scene with that, talking about what it was like for him to have been an astronaut, how that was his whole life, and now what does he have and who is he?
One of the most special jobs a person can have, because how many people can say they've ever been into space?
He says in the movie he's one of a ridiculously small number of humans that have been to space at that point.
Mm-hmm. As for the two lady co-stars, Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger, MacLaine we covered in The Apartment, and she was also really great in Being There a few years before this with Peter Sellers. She'll be 83 in April. Jack will be 80 in April, by the way. MacLaine's still working, and fairly often, too. I think she won the Oscar at least partly because it was a lifetime achievement thing. She'd been good at so many movies she should have won before she finally did, because she's definitely very good in the film. It's not a bad choice, but maybe when she supposedly offered half the Oscar to Winger, who said, I'll take half, they really should have split it, because Winger is at her peak here. She'd been in An Officer and a Gentleman the year before with Richard Gere, and she's terrific in that film, also nominated for that film, and she was in Urban Cowboy the years before that. And then, for that matter, the year before this, in 82, she was part of The Voice. I say part because they had different wrinkles in there, of E.T. with that husky voice she's got. But her career's had huge gaps, and I wonder if maybe she's one of those people that just isn't well enough liked, or maybe she said, to hell with it, I don't want to deal with the BS of Hollywood, maybe because she also was pushed off by people who didn't like the way she was at this point in her life, because it sounds like she was tough to work with.
Yeah, she clearly butt heads with people, but she said herself, I just got sick of telling everybody, I'm going to quit, and I finally just quit. Mm-hmm. And she would step away for years at a time, she would do theater, she's done a little TV here and there, and then every once in a while she comes back and makes a movie. But it sounds to me like it drove her crazy as much as she drove them crazy.
Well, if you don't need the money, then you don't need to act in two or three movies a year. You can take your time and make movies when you really want to.
Yeah.
So I guess good on her for that. It is a bit shocking, though, that the woman who dies of cancer didn't win an Oscar, because usually that's the ticket, right? But not this time.
She's so charming. I can't oversell her performance.
How about her friend Patsy, played by Lisa Hart Carroll? My favorite moment of hers in the whole film, because she is in the movie quite a bit. She's probably the sixth, well, maybe more so than Lithgow, actually. Has probably the fifth most screen time. But that really fun moment where she laughs when one of the oblivious friends says something about, you have cancer, or whatever it is to
I
Emma.
I hear, you have cancer.
And she can't contain her laughter. It's a great moment for her. And she's such an important part of the family that she's still in the funeral scene. She's actually the one who hugs Flap to say, it'll be okay, buddy.
Patsy and Flap are both very much a part of Aurora's life, and they butt heads with her, and they don't really like her, but after all those years, they do kind of have this love. Flap and Aurora have certainly found some common ground by the end of the film.
Yeah, the good of the kids. Well, the man behind the camera for the first time as a director, as I said, Jim Brooks, primarily known as a TV producer for Mary Tyler Moore, Taxi, and then, of course, The Simpsons. Is he the greatest TV producer of all time? He's certainly in the short list. When you could talk about David Chase for Sopranos, maybe people would say him for that one show. Or Vince Gilligan now with both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and being a big part of The X-Files for that matter. But Jim Brooks is in there. I only mentioned those shows. He did Tracy Ullman as well and a lot of other TV shows. He's only directed six movies and he doesn't work all that much. I guess he picks the things he likes the most. But he's been a TV producer pretty much the entire time. And he did base it on Larry McMurtry's 1975 novel. Brooks was the auteur, the writer, director, and producer. The movie's 25-1. We watched the DVD. It's okay, I guess.
Yeah, it's fine. Special.
It's tolerable. It wasn't terrible anyway.
Doesn't need to be an amazing print, so.
Yeah, right. Cinematographer was Andrzej Bartkowiak, I think is how you say his name. Or Andrzej Bartkowiak. I think it's Bartkowiak. Anyway, I like these credits because, of course, this movie, but also The Verdict the year before. That was terrific. Paul Newman film. And then Speed, the action movie that Jan de Bont directed. The editor, Richard Marx, worked on The Godfather Part II and Apocalypse Now. So, of course, he's a Coppola guy. Did a pretty good job with the cutting of this film, I thought, right? Because it's epic story, even though it's not really an epic movie. It takes place over, as you said, many decades.
But it has such a phenomenal flow. You never get bored. The pacing's just really perfect, and the editing feels very invisible, even though there's so much back and forth between the mother, the daughter, and, of course, time jumps.
And Marx was nominated for his editing, as was Michael Gore for that score you hated. He won two Oscars for Fame a few years before that, but after these two movies, he has very few other composer credits. Maybe he didn't like the fact that he didn't keep getting nominations and wins for Oscars and said, the hell with it. One more name I want to mention is Polly Platt, because she was a very important behind-the-scenes player and also the production designer. She was Peter Bogdanovich's ex, and she helped him do Last Picture Show and some of his better movies. A lot of people say that he wasn't nearly as good after he left her, when, of course, he started sleeping with Cybill Shepherd.
Last Picture Show was also based on a McMurtry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we mentioned already. It was one of the ones that got all those Oscar nominations, four of them in that movie.
All these connections.
Mm-hmm. How about that? We already talked about influence. I guess the Evening Star would be the biggest one. 1996, that came out. That was shat upon by critics and crowds. Nobody liked it at all. And then we also made those connections to other movies and everything. So let's move on to the awards and AFI lists. Won the five Oscars for Picture, Director, Best Actress for McLean, Supporting Actor for Jack, and for Brooks' script. So he took home those three Oscars that night. And the six failed nominations. Best Actress for Winger, Supporting Actor for Lithgow, but not Daniels. The Richard Marx editing, the sets, the sound, and the Michael Gore music score that Bev did not like.
Mm-hmm.
It was nominated for the Top 100 Laughs, but didn't make it, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Quotes and didn't make it, but I don't like the quote. She says to him after their date, would you like to come in? I'd rather stick needles in my eyes. Not a bad quote, but not a great one. It doesn't belong on that list. But these other two, how do they not recognize, at least with nominations? Need a lot of booze. Why, did they loosen up or something? No, to kill the bug that you have up your ass. Or even the, give my daughter the shot!
Yes. Incidentally, on the Rotten Tomatoes page, they always have notable quotes near the bottom. And the very first notable quote they have listed for Terms of Endearment was, I want you to put it between your knees. That's from Five Easy Pieces.
Right.
Totally
Rotten
wrong.
Rotten Tomatoes.
It's the number one quote on the page.
Oh, Rotten Tomatoes.
And the second one is the needles in your eyes quote, but I just couldn't believe that. Come on.
Before we do the podcast and I look up all the various nominations for the AFI lists, if it's a quote I don't recognize, I think that says a lot because I've been doing this a long time, looking up this kind of stuff, watching a lot of movies, and I didn't recognize where that quote was from. I knew it was in the movie, of course, but didn't know what scene it was from. And when it comes up, it's fine. If that doesn't stand out, if people aren't ever quoting it now, that's not a great quote.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, well, last thoughts on Terms of Endearment, the final Oscar movie in Oscar month.
It's a little bit dated, and it suffers some weaknesses for being a story about women told almost exclusively by men, but its flaws are easily forgivable.
And the performances are very good, so if you want to blame the content on either Brooks or McMurtry, do that. Pretty hard to blame the acting, because Jack is very good in the movie. And like I say, that one line maybe redeems the whole performance where he's goofing it up and being Jack. Aurora. And then the whole thing she says to him is, who knew you'd turn out to be a good guy? That didn't make me cry, but that was one of the ones that almost got to me more than even the cancer death. Because you root for this guy to turn out to be a good dude, and he is.
It is a moving movie.
And he runs away when Emma comes home with the kids when she's broken up with Flap for a little while. He's very clearly distancing himself from Aurora, and obviously he doesn't really want a part of a family. So him getting back into the thing when he goes to Nebraska, and then him being a part of Tommy's life and inviting him to go swimming at the reception at the funeral, says a lot.
For all the ways I described this movie as a guilty pleasure, I really did think about it for the rest of the week after we watched it. It stuck in my mind, got under my skin. It's just a beautiful story. It really is.
Says a lot. And of course, we didn't say this until now, but it passes the Bechdel test quite easily.
Absolutely. And we mentioned how successful the film is. People still starve for authentic movies about women characters that aren't romances or the typical thing. So imagine how refreshing it was in 1983. No wonder people went out to see it probably more than once, told their friends. No wonder it did so well in the theaters.
And it was second on the box office list that year to Return of the Jedi. Yeah. So basically, if you take the Star Wars movies out of every year they were out, because they were almost always such monster hits compared to everything else, it was really number one, effectively.
The two movies, Return of the Jedi, in terms of endearment, one is a mother and daughter, and the other is a father and son with a pretty troubled relationship.
And the father dies in Return of the Jedi. Spoiler alert! That movie may find its way into your little download list in a couple of months. Anyway, when we gab at you in 7 days, we'll venture overseas to 1920s Germany. It's not Halloween yet, but get ready to be horrified as we review F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. The coming attraction trivia for Nosferatu. How many silent movies have we previously covered on the Top 100 Project and our various offshoots?
Oh, good question.
Nearly 200 podcasts. How many silent films?
So for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, give us a review. Rate us. If you'd like to reach out to Ryan and me, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And you can also reach us on email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, before we go, I would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I died.
I thought it would be a riddle.